Robert Rector notes, in fiscal year 2004, low-skill immigrant households received $30,160 per household in immediate government benefits and services, direct benefits, means-tested benefits, education, and population-based services. In general, low-skill immigrant households received about $10,000 more in government benefits than did the average U.S. household, largely because of the higher level of means-tested welfare benefits received by low-skill immigrant households. In contrast, low-skill immigrant households paid only $10,573 in taxes in 2004. Thus, low-skill immigrant households received nearly $3 in immediate benefits and services for each dollar in taxes paid. The late Minnesota Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Eugene McCarthy wrote, "The United States cannot regain its competitive standing in the world by importing low-wage workers from other countries. On the one hand, it engenders conditions this country cannot and should not tolerate. On the other hand, in the modern age, a nation's wealth and prosperity is secured by high worker productivity and capital investment, not by the availability of low-wage labor. There are other costs to society resulting from open immigration, including crime. The National Youth Gang Survey, 1999 to 2001, published by the Department of Justice, reported that approximately half of all gang members were Hispanic Latino in 2001. In 2005, Assistant FBI Director Chris Swecker told Congress that gangs from California, particularly in the Los Angeles area, have a major influence on Mexican Americans and Central American gangs in this country and in Latin America. The Mara Salvatrucha Gang, or MS-13, is a violent gang composed primarily of Central American immigrants, which originated in Los Angeles and has now spread across the country. MS-13 gang members are primarily from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. They now have a presence in more than 31 states and the District of Columbia. In 2005, the Government Accountability Office reported that, at the federal level, the number of criminal aliens incarcerated increased from about 42,000 at the end of calendar year 2001 to about 49,000 at the end of calendar year 2004, a 15% increase. The percentage of all federal prisoners who are criminal aliens has remained the same over the last 3 years, about 27%. The majority of criminal aliens incarcerated at the end of calendar year 2004 were identified as citizens of Mexico. At the state level, the 50 states received partial reimbursement for incarcerating about 77,000 criminal aliens in fiscal year 2002. At the local level, in fiscal year 2003, the federal government partially reimbursed about 700 local governments for incarcerating about 147,000 criminal aliens. Some state and local governments have expressed concerns about the impact that criminal aliens have on already overcrowded prisons and jails, and that the federal government reimburses them for only a portion of their costs for incarcerating criminal aliens. Health costs and risks are also growing throughout the nation. The late Madeline Pellner Cosman wrote, "By default, we grant health passes to illegal aliens. Yet many illegal aliens harbor fatal diseases that American medicine fought and vanquished long ago, such as drug-resistant tuberculosis, malaria, leprosy, plague, polio, dengue, and Chagas disease." Cosman noted, "The Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, EMTALA, requires every emergency department, ED, to treat anyone who enters with an emergency, including cough, headache, hangnail, cardiac arrest, herniated lumbar disc, drug addiction, alcohol overdose, gunshot wound, automobile trauma, human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, positive infection, mental problem, or personality disorder. The definition of emergency is flexible and vague enough to include almost any condition. Any patient coming to a hospital ED requesting emergency care must be screened and treated until ready for discharge or stabilized for transfer, whether or not insured, documented, or able to pay. A woman in labor must remain to deliver her child. High-technology EDs have degenerated into free medical offices. Between 1993 and 2003, 60 California hospitals closed because half their services became unpaid. Another 24 California hospitals verge on closure. Even ambulances from Mexico come to American EDs with indigence, because the drivers know that EMTALA requires accepting patients who come within 250 yards of a hospital. That geographic limit has figured in many lawsuits. These costs are obviously extremely burdensome to hospitals and physicians. They are either passed on to patients who have insurance, or the hospitals and physicians must absorb them. Moreover, the threat of re-emerging diseases is real and serious. Making matters worse is the government of Mexico. Columbia University professor Claudio Lomnitz argues that in Mexico, corruption has also played a central role in conserving privilege, in keeping competitors out of specific markets, in creating an organized labor sector that stands apart from other sectors of the working class, and in conserving the prerogatives of lineage. Furthermore, the economic model of centralized socialism has led to widespread disparities in income. It is therefore the goal of Mexican authorities to export to the United States the foot soldiers of potential revolution to preserve their society's culture of corruption and privilege. One of the ways in which this is accomplished is by the Mexican government promoting the idea of extraterritorial nationalism among its citizens. That is, the notion that Mexican citizens have an indigenous claim to large swaths of the United States. On July 23, 1997, Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo declared that, "I have proudly affirmed that the Mexican nation extends beyond the territory enclosed by its borders, the southwestern United States, and that Mexican migrants are an important, a very important part of it." This attitude is not confined to Mexican leadership, but rather is shared by the country at large. According to a 2002 survey conducted by Zogby International, 58% of Mexicans agree with the statement, "The territory of the United States Southwest rightfully belongs to Mexico." And the Mexican government is not leaving anything to chance. It is aggressively interfering with the internal affairs of the United States. As Heather McDonald writes, "Mexican leaders have tasked their nation's U.S. consulates with spreading Mexican culture into American schools and communities." There are 47 Mexican consulates in the United States. They publish guides advising their citizens on ways to illegally enter the United States and avoid detection. They help hire lawyers and coordinate with Mexican-American groups to assist illegal immigrants in the United States. They issue matricula consular cards as a way for illegals to obtain privileges that the U.S. usually reserves for legal residents. The consulate started aggressively lobbying American governmental officials and banks to accept matriculas as valid IDs for driver's licenses, checking accounts, mortgage lending, and other benefits. The only type of Mexican who would need such identification is an illegal one. Legal aliens already have sufficient documentation to get driver's licenses or bank accounts. McDonald adds, "Since 1990, Mexico has embarked on a series of initiatives to import Mexican culture into the U.S. Mexico's five-year development plan in 1995 announced that the Mexican nation extends its border into the United States. Accordingly, the government would strengthen solidarity programs with the Mexican communities abroad by emphasizing their Mexican roots and supporting literacy programs in Spanish and teaching of the history, values, and traditions of our country. It seems the Mexican population in the United States has gotten the message. In 2001, just 34% of eligible Mexicans became citizens, compared with 58% of other Latin Americans, 65% of Canadians and Europeans, and 67% of Asians. What is the conservative to make of all this? The evidence of the civil society's degradation cannot be ignored. A confluence of government policies, both long-standing and more recent, is transforming the nation in ways that threaten its survival. The statist, of course, looks over the horizon and sees opportunity. The demographic changes he is importing and protecting empower him. The poor and uneducated enhance the statist's electoral and welfare state constituency. The statist finds common ground with the neo-statist, which is best exemplified by this statement by former Republican vice presidential candidate Jack Kemp. "We are going to make sure that America is open to legal immigration, because that is the wealth and the talent and the entrepreneurial skills for the 21st century." Of course, if legal immigration emphasized wealth, talent, and entrepreneurial skills, American society would be the better for it. Instead, it emphasizes birthright citizenship and chain migration, and encourages illegal immigration, which have led to the current state of immigration anarchy. Alexander Hamilton wrote that the well-being of society depends essentially on the energy of a common national sentiment, on a uniformity of principles and habits, on the exemption of the citizens from foreign bias and prejudice, and on that love of country, which will almost invariably be found to be closely connected with birth, education, and family. He added, "In the composition of society, the harmony of the ingredients is all important, and whatever tends to a discordant intermixture must have an injurious tendency." For the conservative, to say that America is a nation of immigrants and no more is to conflate society with immigration and treat them as equivalents. They are not. Immigration can contribute to the well-being of society, but it can also contribute to its demise. The social contract is a compact between and among Americans, not Americans and the world's citizens. The American government governs by the consent of its citizens, not the consent of aliens and their governments. Moreover, American citizens are not interchangeable with all other citizens. American culture is not interchangeable with all other cultures. And the American government is not interchangeable with all other governments. The purpose of immigration policies must be to preserve and improve the American society. It is all the more astounding, therefore, that the statist and neo-statist nearly succeeded in radically and permanently altering the harmony of the ingredients in American society when, in 2006, they proposed a so-called Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act, which, according to the Heritage Foundation, would have not only granted amnesty to millions of illegal aliens, but would have allowed an estimated 103 million legal aliens to migrate to the United States over 20 years. How? The huge increase in the number of legal aliens and the grant of amnesty to illegal aliens, layered on top of chain migration and birthright citizenship, would have drastically and quickly increased the number of new legal immigrants and the nation's overall population. Moreover, future efforts to limit immigration would have been extremely difficult because of the enormous electoral clout such a significant and largely unassimilated ethnic population would exercise. But the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act's defeat is likely temporary, since President Obama promises to sign it, or something like it, should it reach his desk. The statist has been accustomed to setting immigration policy without notice from the American people. But the people are now witnesses to the events and costs associated with the current state of immigration in their own communities. They have made clear they want some order brought to the chaos. The evidence and prudence guide the conservatives' priorities, which include securing the borders, to prevent not only illegal aliens from crossing into the United States, but criminals and terrorists as well, enforcing current immigration laws, including fining and prosecuting businesses that hire illegal aliens, deporting newly apprehended illegal aliens, and deporting aliens who overstay their visas, denying sanctuary cities federal funds for contributing to lawless behavior, English and assimilation promoted in all the nation's institutions, not bilingualism and multiculturalism, limits on the number of aliens admitted into the country to allow for workable assimilation, the denial of most social services to illegal aliens to deter their migration to the United States, repelling Mexico's interference in the internal affairs of the nation, and the elimination of chain migration and birthright citizenship, which put the aliens' desires before society's well-being. As is his practice, the statist engages in tactics intended to prescribe debate. Those who dissent from his immigration policies are often characterized as exclusionists, nativists, xenophobes, or even racists. The neo-statist offers no alternative to the status quo and condemns the conservative for not going along. He not only accommodates balkanization, but panders to it. But the good citizen contributes to the social cohesion of the civil society for his own benefit and the benefit of that society. And he expects his government to do the same. The conservative believes that to the extent immigration can be applied to that purpose, it is desirable. When it is not, it is destructive of those ends. Chapter 10 On Self-Preservation. The conservative believes that the moral imperative of all public policy must be the preservation and improvement of American society. Similarly, the object of American foreign policy must be no different. The founders recognized that America had to be strong politically, economically, culturally, and militarily to survive and thrive in a complex, ever-changing global environment, not only in their time, but for all time. History bears this out. After the Revolutionary War, the founders realized that the Confederation was inadequate to conduct foreign affairs, since each state was free to act on its own. There could be no coherent national security policy, because there was no standing army, and each state ultimately was responsible for its own defense. The nation's economy was vulnerable to pirates who were terrorizing transatlantic shipping routes and thereby inhibiting trade and commerce. And the British and Spanish empires were looming threats. The authority of the national government to raise and maintain a standing army and use military power within the framework of a republican system was among the first matters addressed by the framers when they presented the finished constitution to the states for ratification. After reviewing a litany of European interests and conflicts in North America, John Jay in Federalist 4 wrote, "The people of America are aware that inducements to war may arise out of these circumstances, as well as from others not so obvious at present, and that whenever such inducements may find fit time and opportunity for operation, pretenses to color and justify them will not be wanting. Wisely, therefore, do they consider union and a good national government as necessary to put and keep them in such a situation as, instead of inviting war, will tend to repress and discourage it. The situation consists in the best possible state of defense, and necessarily depends on the government, the arms, and the resources of the country. Indeed, one of the stated purposes of the Constitution is to provide for the common defense." The framers understood the complementary purposes of domestic and foreign policy. George Washington's farewell address of 1796 is often misunderstood as a proclamation of isolationism. This ignores its historical context. At the time, Washington was concerned with the very survival of the young nation. The address is a call for prudence, not only in dealings and relationships with foreign states, but in issues that threaten national unity. In his address, Washington warned against the influences of popular passions on establishing permanent and overarching allegiances to, or prejudices against, any foreign power. He issued his warning because the American public was deeply divided in its sentiments relating to the European powers that were at war. The nascent political parties, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, or Democratic Republicans, were coalescing around support for different countries, the Federalists for Britain, the Anti-Federalists for France. Throughout his presidency, Washington tried to steer a course of strict neutrality between the two countries, while promoting commercial relationships and vigorous trade with both sides in the conflict. The address makes clear he did so, not because neutrality was an end in itself, but because he feared that taking sides could split the country apart. Washington also believed that the nation's survival required a strong national defense. In his first annual message to Congress on January 8, 1790, barely 8 months after taking office, Washington said, "Among the many interesting objects which will engage your attention, that of providing for the common defense will merit particular regard. To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving peace." In his fifth annual message on December 3, 1793, Washington offered a stronger, more substantial elaboration of this principle. "There is a rank due to the United States among nations which will be withheld, if not absolutely lost, by the reputation of weakness. If we desire to avoid insult, we must be able to repel it. If we desire to secure peace, one of the most powerful instruments of our rising prosperity, it must be known that we are at all times ready for war." But few knew better than Washington that America must establish alliances that have as their purpose the protection and well-being of the nation. Without the crucial material aid and military support of France and other nations, the decisive Battle of Yorktown and perhaps the Revolutionary War itself might have been lost. Washington was neither an isolationist nor an interventionist. Yes, Washington was skeptical of alliances, but when in America's best interests, he made them. Washington preferred diplomacy to war, but he knew war was sometimes unavoidable. By word and deed, as general, president, and statesman, Washington spent his public life pursuing the preservation and improvement of American society. Washington's example is thus flexibility in means to achieve the immutable end, national security. Agreeing with Washington, Claremont Institute Senior Fellow and University of Dallas Professor Thomas West writes, "For the founders, foreign and domestic policy were supposed to serve the same end, the security of the people in their person and property. Therefore, foreign policy was conceived primarily as defensive. Foreign attack was to be deterred by having strong arms or repulsed by force. Alliances were to be entered into with the understanding that a self-governing nation must keep itself aloof from the quarrels of other nations, except as needed for national defense. Government had no right to spend the taxes or lives of its own citizens to spread democracy to other nations, or to engage in enterprises aiming at imperialistic hegemony." West would also agree, however, that a defensive foreign policy does not exclude the necessity of preemptive action. In 1787, James Wilson, a prominent founder, rejected the argument that America had to wait until attacked to exercise military power, and mocked the proponents of this notion. "Whatever may be the provocation, however important the object in view, and however necessary dispatch and secrecy may be, still the declaration must precede the preparation, and the enemy will be informed of your intentions, not only before you are equipped for an attack, but even before you are fortified for a defense. The consequence is too obvious to require any further delineation." Of course, there are occasions when America has suffered grievously, including on 9/11, for failing to act preemptively. Moreover, in the age of rogue regimes pursuing nuclear weapons, there clearly are occasions when preemption is prudent. For a government to be irresolute in the face of a growing or imminent threat to its citizenry is suicidal. What of the notion of spreading democracy to other nations, which in one form or another appears to be part of the strategy of recent administrations of both political parties? In 2005, columnist George Will put the question to William F. Buckley, Jr., asking about the war in Iraq. Will: today we have a very different kind of foreign policy, and the premise of the Bush Doctrine is that America must spread democracy because our national security depends upon it, and America can spread democracy. It knows how. It can engage in nation building. This is conservative or not? Buckley: it's not at all conservative. It's anything but conservative. It's not conservative at all, inasmuch as conservatism doesn't invite unnecessary challenges. It insists on coming to terms with the world as it is, and the notion that merely by affirming these high ideals we can effect highly entrenched systems. Will: but something odd is happening in conservatism, and we have a president, George W. Bush, and an administration that clearly is conservative, accepted as that. Yet it is nation-building in the Middle East. And conservatism seems to be saying government can't run Amtrak, but it can run the Middle East. Buckley: the ambition of conservatism properly extends to saying that where there are no human rights, it's not a society I can truly respect. It's impossible to draw up a template that gives us an orderly sense of send democracy there, but let this go for a while. One recognizes that you can't export democracy everywhere simultaneously. Certainly America cannot export democracy everywhere simultaneously, nor should it attempt to. For one thing, it is impractical. There are cultures and regimes that are not receptive to such overtures. Furthermore, the loss of American lives and the enormous financial costs in chasing such unrealistic ends would threaten the preservation and improvement of American society. It would demoralize the population and desensitize it to real threats that endanger the society. However, there are occasions when democracy building is prudent. The European Recovery Program, better known as the Marshall Plan of 1948, had among its purposes the promotion and preservation of democracy through the provision of billions of dollars in economic and military aid to several European nations defeated in World War II. Among other things, it would and did help repel the spread of Soviet communism through what remained of free Europe, which was clearly in America's interests. More recently, while democracy may not take hold in Afghanistan for the long term, it is still a perfectly sound objective, given the vacuum that was filled by the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the aftermath of the Soviet Union's defeat in that country and America's subsequent disassociation. The key is that these decisions must never be motivated by utopianism or imperialism, but by actual circumstances requiring the defense of America against real threats. As for Iraq, the Will Buckley exchange suggests their opposition to the war was a larger criticism of a perceived doctrine requiring the imposition of democracy worldwide, although Will has also called Iraq a war of choice. America has engaged in wars of choice in the past, including during the 19th century, when, under the banner of manifest destiny, the United States government increased American territory by military threat and force, to include the Southwest, West, and Pacific Northwest. The expansion of the nation's contiguous borders has undoubtedly improved American society. While America may have felt threatened from Britain, Mexico, and other countries that controlled these territories, the fact is that the nation was intent on expansion. If the war in Iraq is understood as an effort to defeat a hostile regime that threatened both America's allies and interests in the region, the war and the subsequent attempt at democratic governance in that country can be justified as consistent with founding and conservative principles. Indeed, since the Will Buckley exchange, when victory in Iraq appeared elusive to some, changes in military and political strategies dramatically improved the situation. Of course, Iraq is not necessarily a model for future engagements, but nor can it be easily dismissed as unreasonable and imprudent. Saddam's Iraq had a history of aggressive behavior against America's ally, Kuwait, and threatened Saudi Arabia, and had actively pursued nuclear weapons, such as Iraq's Oseiroc nuclear reactor, destroyed by Israel in 1981. The United States and its allies no longer faced the prospect of a nuclear Iraq under the control of a megalomaniac. For now, at least, it is one less destabilizing threat to American interests.